understand.
Yeah, it's not a...
He's really serious.
Not a... It looks like a new one or something.
Hollow.
Yes, it's not a very hollow. It is. I'm calling the Finance and Administration Committee meeting to order. Our first action is approval of the agenda. Are there any additions, corrections, or changes to the agenda? Without objection, the agenda is approved as presented. Minutes. We have the minutes from February 10th. Are there any additions, corrections, changes to the minutes? Without objection, the minutes are approved as presented. Our first action item is on traction power cable. Mr. Kubitschek.
Good morning. This is basically in regards for basically just traction power cable. Us looking to continue an ongoing program. This cable material is very important for us because the continuation of 8-car trains, the running of them, while there was a 50% 8-car train initiative to upgrade the substations and the power, this is a route about ensuring that the grid itself is able to sustain that. Also ties in with some of the NTSB recommendations in which we were basically making sure that we were doing our safety analysis of our system and making sure that we didn't have any cross-communications between our train control and our traction power. Next slide, please. Looks like the presentation's out of sequence. Basically, we do have an existing you know, cable contract, but based on some of our studies and everything else, what we're trying to do is make sure that we stay out in front of these efforts so that way we have our options and stuff available in front of us. The worst thing that we could do is basically, since we have momentum on the project and the program, is to get into an area where we have to halt this exercise. We do have an existing cable, you know, contract that expires towards the end of this year, and the new contract will be required to continue this ongoing effort. Additional items that we're also going to help ensure that we sustain this possibility is add miscellaneous items like lugs, clamps, brackets, everything else, trying to standardize everything on our approach so that way we're not piecemealing in respective areas and taking advantage of the economy of scale. Benefits, again, just helps improve the track circuit reliability because since the return also goes to the rail where the same thing with the ATC is, if you have any imbalance with your power, it definitely will impact your train control. Again, reliability speaks for itself. We touched briefly on the 8-car train operation. As this grid continues and we continue to add cars, we have to make sure that we stay out in front of these the older cabling that's out there, as well as we go through with the NTSB recommendations. When we start ohming and everything else, we know that we're probably going to find additional materials out there that just weren't covered or addressed with the old practices. Next slide, please. The recommendation is to initiate and award the contract. Basically, also allows to do a multi-year contract for the cable installation, and this would be for 3 capital-funded positions to provide additional project management, engineering, services, and field support. This would be associated with this specific effort.
So you're looking for a motion to initiate and award contracts within budget?
Yes, sir.
Both in fiscal 12 and in future years, is that right?
Yes, sir.
And you're adding 3 staff people who are only for this purpose. And one of the things that some of us talked about earlier is to make sure that we, as we add people into our capital budget, do so in such a way that we minimize the implications of those people leaving again should there be no projects for them to work on. Okay. Mr. Giancola.
Yes, thank you. Question on the traction power cables. I mean, how much are they a factor in preventing us from using 8-car trains, or are they?
The cables that we have, if they are not functioning properly, theoretically, you couldn't run any rail cars, regardless of length. That's how important this cabling is. It doesn't matter if it's a four-car train, six-car train, or eight-car train. The main focus here is that the cabling that we're putting in is a little bit larger. It's sized properly to support eight-car trains. And what we're addressing here is existing infrastructure that has been in place from day one.
And just a follow-up, the current system is scheduled for completion in 2023, I read. Will this contract action today shorten that period, and if so, by how much?
It won't necessarily shorten it at this time frame. We are doing our evaluation, as you know, in the out years where we're looking at the capital improvement projects, where we're looking at where there was one for 75% eight-car trains as well as 100% eight-car trains. What this really does is really focus on keeping us at a state of good repair. And in the areas of where we know that we're doing these calculations for 100% eight-car trains, we are putting the infrastructure in place one time instead of having to go back and do it several times in the future, because we know that sooner or later the system will be increased.
Thank you.
So I think the cost savings and the time savings will really be on the back end whenever we start looking at actual substation installation.
Mr. Downey?
Yeah, two questions. One on the nature of the contract, because I understand that you are separately procuring the cable and the installation. So we furnish the cable to the winner of the installation contract?
Yes, so we have kind of like a joint usage on this, because we do have some of our own cable, own cable crews that we work in, that we also do in smaller areas, because this cable is not only used on the main line, but also in our yards and everything else. So we found out it works better, and that we're also able to ensure the better quality control.
And that, is there competition in the cable world?
Yes, there is.
Yeah, good. And the other question was on NTSB. As I read the NTSB recommendations, this is a piece, but a relatively small piece, something that does need to be done, but there's still a lot more that has to be done on this NTSB.
That is correct.
Thank you.
It's a very important piece.
Ms. Hines?
Mr. Benjamin, this is just a procedural question. We're not actually authorizing this contract to be done today, right? This is a, we're then going to recommend it to ourselves for 2 weeks from today. Is that correct?
That's correct. Anything we do in committee has got to go to the board before an action fully in effect.
I just wanted to verify that.
Yes. Mr. McKay.
I was going to just put a motion on the table that I move approval.
Second. It's been moved and seconded. Any other discussion? All in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed, no.
Okay.
Sounds like this one where we had no option. We actually said send it on to the board. FTA asset management pilot, Mr. Kubicek again.
Okay. What I'm going to do is I'm going to ask Mr. Randy Posey to help lead the presentation on this, and I'll support as needed.
Good morning. This item we're bringing to the board addresses two asset management grants. The first one is a $1 million grant that is focused on the development of an asset management model for the agency. FTA is in the process of trying to get a number of properties, major properties around the country, to produce these models, and from that they want to develop a generic model that can be migrated to the 300 or 400 some properties that don't have the financial or technical means to produce something like this. And what we're asking today is for the committee's recommendation to authorize our application for that grant. It also ties into a grant which we have previously been awarded, totaling $3 million, $2.4 million in federal funds and $600,000 in local matching funds, also to do state of good repair asset management. In 1998, the agency engaged a consulting firm, Frederick Harris, to do a complete review and tabulation of the agency's capital assets. This study was completed, put in place, and it also included some life cycle determinations for the assets and some costing. And this product was utilized actively by the capital program offices for planning and project development up through 2002. It was also utilized through 2005 for the development of the Metro Matters program. In terms of the quality of the product, it was excellent, but it was only one small component of an asset management system that we have never really had in place in the agency. And what we're trying to do with these two grants, the one we've been awarded and the one that we've applied for, is to develop a comprehensive asset management system that will touch virtually every office in the agency that utilizes capital assets in some form. Next slide. What, as part of the Harris study outcome, there was no formal administrative structure that was put in place. And what we're going to try and do here is formalize and institutionalize all the asset management processes we need to do effective maintenance, effective planning, effective budgeting. What we want to do with this $3 million grant is find a way to connect the frontline mechanics and the engineers who actually touch these assets, gather this data, process it so that it goes through our systems and becomes useful information for the planners, the budgeters, the management, and other staff. We are trying to improve our overall planning and decision making. We have a wide range of short life and long life assets, but we need to get away from the thinking where we just replace components, replace stuff. And even the short life assets are all part of systems, some of these very complex systems. And how we plan, procure, fund, implement these is of critical importance going forward, because we have to achieve some economies of scale, economies of process, and economies of technology. Our office is involved in developing 50-year asset plans. And one reason we're engaged in this is because many of the assets we have don't show up in our typical planning processes. We've just awarded a contract for the 7000 series rail cars, 748 vehicles in the entire project, $2.1 billion program. These vehicles are going to be in service until 2053. But before that first 7000 series rail car is delivered, I expect to be back in front of the committee with the 8000 series rail car program, another $2 billion program. And what we are trying to do is put in place tools that will let us function in a dynamic environment where we can address process changes, technology changes with reliability and some degree of certainty, certainly rationality and consistency. So we're asking the board to let us utilize these grants, certainly the $1 million grant if it's available, to put this asset management system in place.
Let me just clarify exactly what you're asking us to do. First of all, for the there are two grants, as I understand it.
Yep.
One we have already received for $3 million. And what are you asking us to do relative to that $3 million grant? Just increase the size of the capital program and authorize contracts under it?
We want to create a capital project for asset management and start that with the $3 million in the first grant. Authorize the general manager to initiate and award contracts or agreements. We will probably partner with one or more agencies or entities in the development of this, and so there would be an agreement involved in that. And we're asking for one capital position to help implement and manage this program as it goes forward.
You know, the certainly the explanation that you've given is a very good one, and it's the kind of thing we really need to do is to manage our assets and understand what we have and how, when we need to replace it, and what's being used where and how. In this first one where we've received the grant, it was for $2.4 million.
Correct.
And there's a $600,000 match. Has that already been authorized by this board, or is that part of what you're asking for?
The application for the grant was authorized. The local match is currently going through an approval process by the jurisdictions.
Okay, so this is money that was not obligated under Metro Matters and doesn't automatically roll over, is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's correct.
And so the jurisdictions have to say yes before this board can say yes?
Yes.
So are we doing this contingent upon their saying yes?
That's correct.
Okay, so we would formally, when we do our board meeting, but this committee would be making a recommendation that, subject to the jurisdiction saying that that money can be kept here at Metro, and our presumption is that nobody really wants to get the money back, this would become local match, and that's part of the action.
I will add that I believe, and Randy can correct me, that we have most of the jurisdiction's agreement on if this is a good use of a match. We're waiting, I think, on maybe one. Is that correct?
Because it's in the resolution.
Yeah.
That's already done. Okay.
I think just one is.
Okay.
All right. So we will, hopefully, by the time that we have to act as a board, have that? We're still trying to determine. Mr. Downs.
I believe the district is the one who has not agreed. The district would like to formally request that its share of the jurisdiction funds be returned to the WMATA jurisdiction account.
Yeah, and I apologize. It was three, the district, as you mentioned, the city of Fairfax, and what was the third one? Fairfax County. Those
okay, did I understand, Mr. Downs, that the district is not at this point agreeing?
That's true.
Okay. So do you have an alternative plan, since if we approve this, we would not have a local match?
Not at this time. We'd have to actually go back to see if there is an additional match, but we actually currently have all of our funds earmarked. So unless we delay another project, we would have to forego the grant on this.
Okay. And I'm not quite sure then what the committee action would be at this point if those funds wouldn't be available. We could act on the $1 million and certainly authorize that.
I guess I make a suggestion. It could be contingent on, now that we understand the direction as provided by the board member, we can actually, prior to the board meeting, determine whether or not we have available funds to make up that piece of the match, and have that ready before the board takes any action at the board.
From another source, which is not already a match for federal funds.
And that, right, and that would not have an impact on another project. So we can do that analysis.
Or that would have an impact that we can tolerate.
Right.
Okay, Mr. Downey.
Yeah, I would think foregoing the availability of this system would not be a good direction to move in.
Agreed.
I did have a question about the two grants. Do they have independent utility? if we were not to get the $1 million, is the $3 million still a?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. And the $1 million is without match because it's FTA looking to build something that's of national.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And Mr. Chair, Mr. Wells, for clarification, it doesn't sound like there's a definitive answer to this. And so for clarification, it would be helpful to get a definitive answer if there's any other funds that could be used to meet the match.
Yeah, we will do that.
Thank you.
And presumably we will have to go back to the jurisdictions and let them all know that the district is asking for all of its funds back, which may trigger them saying that they would like to do that as well.
Actually, I don't have that as a requirement. I mean,
I understand, but I think it would probably be a good idea.
Okay, I understand the direction then. Thank you.
And that would have a much larger budgetary impact because that then becomes additional funds that would not be available either for match or for direct expenditure from the jurisdictions of all of the funds that are rolled over, which I believe you have already programmed as
yeah.
being
mm-hmm.
part of the budget. Yeah.
If I may, there's approximately $42 million worth of Metro Matters residual funds remaining, 35 are federal funds, some of which require a match, $7 million are the jurisdictional funds. Returning all of the jurisdictional funds would likely mean that some of the federal funds, that we couldn't leverage some of the federal funds that, Mr. Benjamin, you're correct, have been programmed in the FY12 through 17 CIP.
So unless we took some other local funds that were available and made them match, we would lose both federal and local funds.
Some portion of the federal funds, yes, sir.
Okay, so this is an issue that we really need to look into very carefully that came up sort of sideways in this discussion because it has a rather substantial impact on our finances and our capital program.
Actually, I need to have clarification on the district's position because I'm not sure I'm following it. We actually were looking to get just the match for this particular grant, the $600,000. And if the district's position is to have that refund, that portion of it refunded, or I think what Matt just brought up was a bigger issue, which is the one that he just indicated, that it's really a $7 million local match, local money that we have left over, which is used to match a broader federal amount, over $40 million. And is the district's position to have their portion of the $7 million returned?
The issue is the current request for the $600,000,
okay.
not the $7 million.
Yep.
It is not on the table.
Right. Okay. I understand. Thank you.
So that's an issue that still needs to be explored, and all jurisdictions need to be part of that process so that we know what's going on.
Thank you. Okay.
So an appropriate motion at this point would be a restricted motion, or are you convinced that you can, between now and the board meeting, come up with a local match source?
I think I can come up with something, but of course it's predicated on the how the other jurisdictions feel about that, so.
I would like.
Okay.
All right. I'm sorry, what?
I want something contingent that if we get it one way or the other, okay. then it will go through. I want the whole
So do we want a postponed action on the $3 million and act only on the $1 million? We want to act conditionally, or what would you like us to do?
What I'd like to do is if the board could approve the $1 million application, and on the $3 million, the recommendation to the board is contingent upon staff demonstrating that the local match will be in place.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mr. Downey and
Ms. Hewlett. It wouldn't seem likely to me that FTA would want to give us $1 million if we're giving back their $3 million.
I would hope that we wouldn't end up doing that, Ms. Hewlett.
Well, I was just trying to make the motion, actually.
Okay. Please go ahead. Make the motion.
I'm trying here. I think the motion is to move approval of the grant applications conditioned upon the jurisdictional match from all the respective jurisdictions, or in the alternative, some other appropriate source of funds for whatever for the
Could I modify your motion before you make it?
That's fine.
Because we are moving two things.
That's true.
It's the 1 million, which is the application, and the 3 million, which we already have awarded.
Right.
For which we have to identify local share. So we are moving the 1 million no matter what, not conditional.
Correct.
And the 3 million conditioned upon staff between now and the board meeting coming up with an acceptable source of local funds.
Right.
And is that your motion?
That's where I was headed with it. First, I was starting off with the 3 million, but yes, the 1 million is regardless, yes.
And also, you wanted additional staff position.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, is that part of the
motion? One additional staff position.
Okay, it has been so moved. Do we have a second? Okay, second by Ms. Hutchins. Any other comments? All in favor, say aye. Aye. Opposed, no. We have winded our way through this one. Now you want to do a reprogramming after all of this?
Yes, sir.
And this is money that we really have, right?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Okay. I'll try to go through this if needed. I might call up some staff. The gist of this is really basically to modify and increase 10.2 million in contract authority. One area is going to focus on is $6.2 million on standpipe. The other balance is going to be focused on the chillers and HVAC. We're looking at moving funds around at 11 and also in 12 and 13, applying those within the CIP 138. Next slide, please. The standpipe background. This program started back in 1998. Basically, there's been seven design contracts that have been completed. For the contracts, based on the current criteria, has design errors, which were not initially detected. Basically, you had the application of their design was surrounding the pump pressure actually for a fire truck versus the actual standpipe pressure. And there was the reputable firm that we worked with, there was an error, and we're in the middle of going back and forth with them on their potential design issue and how they approach things. Since this has been such a long, ongoing, project, the main focus of this at this stage is to ensure that we meet the most recent code that all of the local fire departments and jurisdictions, follow to attain. This was found as it's during part of the normal overall replacement program that has been ongoing, like I said, for several years. The systems which are basically impacted are primarily in the District of Columbia, and we have met with the Montgomery County as well on this. There's a combination of different sizes of piping, and just to kind of give you an overall magnitude of how large our network of plumbing is just to support standpipes and fire lines, it's over 550,000 feet. So it's a very, very complex process, and you've got multiple sizes of pipes and stuff that are in there. Again, we have water pressure. Again, it gets into a matter of how much is actually at the nozzle versus what the fire departments can actually press or push out with their fire trucks. And our meetings with them has been focused in a joint review of the areas that we've targeted in the overall presentation to kind of target those are the key areas. There's been work that's been ongoing, so this is a very fluid process from a standpoint as they replace other certain sizes of pipes and infrastructure. It does have a direct impact on this overall network of fire lines.
Mr. Giancola has a question.
Yes.
Yeah, the operative word that you commented on was design errors, which piqued my interest. And, clearly, I don't know when this contract was completed or, in fact, who the firm was, but under errors and omissions, have we gone back to get the design engineer or company to pay for some of these improvements? And a related question is, certainly we do get, most projects require a fire protection engineer to certify the design as well. And was that done on this project?
Yes, we are going back, reaching back to the original designer of this. Again, the firm has done this in other locations. What brought this about was the criteria that they stamped off and used versus the requirements that are being applied today. And that's where the disconnect is at this time. And as we continue to work with this designer and review this, we have to basically be very cautious in our calculations and our reviews to make sure that ultimately we're meeting what the local fire departments need of us for this system.
Related to, again, I asked about the fire protection certification as well. Fire protection engineer usually has to approve that. And then also, did this company have the appropriate insurance to cover those kinds of costs?
That is all part of the review process. But this firm that we've worked with has done this work before. They were specially brought into this agency back in that time frame. And they sealed the plans. Yes, and they sealed the plans. And again, we're dating this back to 1998.
And are you saying that at that time they met standards, that met the local standards requirements, or they did not meet the local requirements?
Since this is such a large, you know, system and replacement, as you start adjusting pipes, running different locations and stuff, you know, it's easy to judge and grade whenever you've just replaced 10 feet. But whenever you have hundreds of thousands of feet that's been replaced and you're in part of the process as you're installing and testing and stuff, that's where the change in criteria came into place from a standpoint of what they were actually reading and seeing, and that's what's caused us to go back to the review back to day one because, again, it's an entire network, not just a singular area.
Are the pipes that are currently there, do they meet the standards that existed, design standards that existed at the time that this was originally done?
Yes, yes. The pipes do meet the standards and what they were signed off and sealed. It was a matter of, since the system, some of the standpipe systems were put back in, you know, in the 70s, you know, this was part of a maintenance effort. And so, in fact, in some ways, some of the other views and stuff we've had, calcification and everything else, were, you know, pipes were literally just, you know, 100% closed. So what we've been putting in definitely has made the system better, but we're getting to ensure that we have an exact standard across the board.
But what you're telling me is that you believe that what we originally installed met what were the local jurisdictional requirements for safety at the time?
Yes.
And does that mean that there are any potential safety hazards for our passengers at the present time?
No. We are, again, that's why we brought in the fire departments to talk about what was taking place and working with testing with them. And I know that they've been briefed, and a lot of folks have reached out to them as well. And we seem to have good support with our plan.
And you're saying that there have been new codes that have come into place since that time, and that we're now trying to meet the new codes at a higher standard?
I would say that some of the codes have been there for quite some time. It's just a matter of the way that the engineering firm signed and sealed their respective design.
Okay, I'm trying to get towards the question of, is there really any danger to our passengers? I think you answered that, and that is no. But we are upgrading at a higher level than where things were at the time that it was originally installed. Is that right?
We've got better performance in the majority of the areas compared to the original design. A lot of it was replaced in kind, but there was other areas of the system that were modified that whenever we go back to do these tests, as we extend the network, we just don't have the flow per the code requirements that we're applying now.
The code requirements we're applying now, but that doesn't imply that we couldn't put out a fire and it would be a potential safety problem. Okay. Mr. McKay.
Two questions. One, I think a simple one, back to the insurance issue. Is the question whether or not this entity has insurance now relative to this? I certainly hope the question isn't whether or not they had the proper insurance in 1998 when we did business with them. I would assume that's a part of a typical standard part of our procurement process.
I mean, all firms that the agency work with are, you know, be licensed, bonded, you know, throughout. So definitely, there was no, the agency had that at that time. and still continue with everybody that we work with.
So the question really is whether or not they are still carrying that. That's just going back to your earlier question. I don't want anyone leaving with the impression that we don't know if this entity had insurance or not when we did business with them. We knew that they did.
They did.
Okay. And my second question is, and I think what Mr. Benjamin was raising is the most important thing, the safety of our passengers. I've seen, you know, I don't see any here, in here anywhere where it really gives me a clear idea of the sense of urgency. I mean, I understand this is an important issue, and I've seen the fire marshal on TV talking about it. I just heard that it's not really a safety issue for our passengers. And so as we're dealing with a multitude of safety issues on a daily basis, I'm having a hard time understanding, and maybe you can explain a little bit more clearly to me, how this issue has such a sense of urgency that it's requiring us to reprogram money immediately to deal with, and how that relates to the rest of the safety issues that we're dealing with as a board.
Well, on my part, when this was brought forward, you know, to me and brought to my attention, you know, knowing the amount of people and stuff that we move and the sensitivity that we have, if it's a fire-related item and we're not within code, for me it's one of the utmost important things that we need to address. This is also an area where it's straight, it's, you know, it's pipe, it's materials. It's going to take a while to get out you know, a couple of years, 2 to 3 years to get everything replaced. But I would urge that we do not procrastinate on this. It does concern me whenever we do not meet certain codes and compliance. And not that we would ever have a fire or anything else, but just in case, you know, just never know. And I would not want to be put in a position towards we were not actively trying to address a situation that we knew that we had a potential issue with.
But this is not moving ahead of or conflicting with any other urgent safety matter that
No.
we would be dealing with. This is running strictly parallel to the other work program we have of dealing
Yes.
with our safety
Yeah, issues. That's why we're going out into some of the out years where, you know, we haven't spent some of the funds, and basically it's to address it sooner than later.
Mr. Chairman. And it's my understanding that workarounds are being developed with the fire departments.
Absolutely.
To make best
Absolutely.
Use of what's there in the
yeah.
event of an emergency.
Yes, we actually, Chief Taborn was very instrumental in getting the fire departments, you know, together, working with our emergency management internally. So it wasn't just, say, for instance, the engineering perspective or WMATA meeting with them, but we had emergency management. We had our safety department there. We had transit police, because this is truly a joint effort, and they've already started doing testing and stuff, even in lieu of this presentation and everything else. And then the existing contract that we had working and stuff, we already kind of adjusted some of our design and some of our calculations that were initially assessed. The replacement and repairs that they're making are proven to be very positive, so we're moving along. It's just that we don't want to break the momentum of what we have underway at this time.
Any other comments? Ms. Hutchins?
I just wanted to make sure that your message was clearly stated, because it's stated on page 36 at the beginning there, where it is a priority because
yes.
it is a safety life issue. And that's where we are.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, one thing, if we just don't know about it and you're not aware, but now we're at a stage right now that we're aware of the situation, and we must address it.
You have some more of your presentation?
Yes, there's a skipping through. And again, this is also just a snapshot of what's also was shared with the fire department, and they have actually much greater detail, even elevation maps and everything else, and systematically we're going through that, so that's working very nicely. Next slide is basically talking about cooling for station chillers. Being that summer is going to be upon us here before we know it, we got an opportunity to basically to accelerate some of our work to address things sooner than later. The Mount Vernon chiller, for example, is installed in 1978. It's no longer, you know, economically to repair. We need to replace the whole thing, you know, in kind. Again, this includes not only just the chiller itself, but we're going after all the controls and everything else to make sure that whenever we do this work and walk away from it, we won't be going back to this station for quite some time. Basically, we're also looking at other areas, other systems and yards, U Street, Navy Yard, Pentagon City have a lot of corrosion and scale buildup. So we're looking to do some work and stuff in that as well, in those areas as well. And the last bullet, even the cooling towers, where we have actual good chillers that are actually working, but some of the ductwork and everything else is cracked. Some of the areas have been actually designed into the stations themselves, so we'll actually have to patch some of the stations and everything else. So we've got a chiller that's working at optimal capacity, but it can't get any, it can't basically flow out into the rest of the system. And so that's what all of this work is aligned for. Okay. The next slide here gives you kind of a price.
We have a question up here.
Yes.
Mr. Giancola?
Yeah, I may be a little ahead of the game. I've been reading ahead, but you've got CIP 107, the red line rehab from DuPont Circle to Silver Spring, yet the reprogramming of dollars is going into a project that appears to be beyond the scope of the original contract. So are we also, besides reprogramming, amending the contract to include those other stations?
Can you restate your question
again? All right. CIP 107 is the red line rehab from DuPont Circle to Silver Spring. And I guess the real question is there enough flexibility in there to include work outside that scope, which would be, include the Bethesda and Woodley Park stations?
Yes, there is.
Okay. In other words, we didn't need a contract modification. Just the reprogramming.
It's the reprogramming.
Okay, thank you.
It's basically, it's also just a matter of just scheduling of the work is why we want to move this forward. Okay. Basically, this kind of gives you another snapshot of what the equipment stuff looks like, and we do provide a breakdown, you know, on pricing, you know, per location. And then the recommendation is asking for the board to approve modifications to existing standpipe rehab contract, contract FN 5068, and up it from 6.2 to 9 million, for totaling out to 15.2 million, increasing the overall authorization for the JOC, and then also reprogramming of some funds within the FY 2011 capital project.
Let me try again to summarize what we're doing here. Your grand total, which covers both fiscal 11 and fiscal 12, according to the need, is $10.2 million?
Yes.
Of which 3.7 is a reprogramming, and the rest is money that's already in budgets?
Yes.
And you're asking us to approve the reprogramming, to increase a specific contract to $15 million, and to increase another contract by $4
million? Yes.
Okay, all of which adds up to the 10.2 over 2 years.
Yes.
And you've identified the sources of those funds.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Can I have a motion to approve that?
Second.
Mr. Giancola, seconded by Mr. Downey.
Question.
Question, Mr. McKay.
In the reprogramming, item 4, Royal Street Bus Garage, it mentions in there that reprogramming this money, but that additional funding might be required. Are we to assume that that would mean that the $2.7 million that is being reallocated is going to be needed at a future date, and that means that jurisdictional increases will have to occur to support that in this out-year CIP?
No, actually, if that will not occur. We are now on an expenditure-based budget, as you recall. So what happens is if we have, in this particular example, if funds are not needed in the current year, will not be expended, we're moving them to a project that's right and ready. And when those funds are required, specifically on this project, the Royal Street Royal Bus Garage, funds will be available. It's programmed into our 6-year program.
And as a follow-up, since this item was just approved in Fairfax County, from a land use perspective, the next step is acquisition.
Yes.
Are you on clear terms telling us that by reprogramming this money, there will be no problem when it comes time to acquire this property, which might be very soon, and that there are no other financial implications to the timeline of this project?
Is John Thomas here?
Yeah. Yeah, again, yes, sir. The same team has been working with the Cinder Bid project, is the same team that's been involved in this as well, and that's come up in our discussions. And we'll have the money. And nobody at that time has expressed any issue or concern because we did discuss this in advance, knowing the timing of all of these other activities that are taking place.
Okay. Thank you.
We have a motion on the table. All in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed, no.
That was a pretty complicated one. Ms. Kissel.
Okay. Try to make mine simple. This actually is a follow-up from follow-up discussion in our continuing discussions, our development of our FY12 budget. Under the backdrop, actually, of the discussions that we had earlier today in the Customer Operations Committee with regard to WMATA providing the maintenance and capital and service impact to the capital program that we are going to follow up on in June-July timeframe. I'd like to take the time in this presentation to have the committee review the existing service criteria that we currently have as a policy for a bus, and also to lay out a potential schedule for the committee with regard to public input. So that's the purpose of this presentation. As you know, and just the next two pages are really just reminders of the proposed budget as submitted by the general manager. You can go to the next slide. Was a balanced budget and assumed current levels of service as well as subsidy increase. And if you look at this slide, you'll see that in his budget, we had addressed continued cost reductions in the form of structural cost changes as well as the implementation of efficiency programs that we're putting in place, which do include capital investments that will reduce operating costs. So this is just a slide that you've seen before. The total amount of those initiatives are $74 million reduction in the operating cost on the operating side. And they are already included in the general manager's budget proposal. We also actually, on the next slide, as a reminder, we also put together options for the board to consider with respect to other options besides a subsidy increase, and as you can see here, they're listed here. I won't go through them again. Based upon the committee's discussion at last month's meeting, the board requested that staff build a framework to help establish other options, which reflected the discussion that was had at that time on potential service modifications. And the committee wanted the staff to discuss this with the JCC and have a dialogue with them in order for the members of the board to get some, to build this framework and to have this discussion. So, and additionally, bring this back to the board at this committee to have that discussion. On the next page, we really show a timeline, if you will, on what's happened since that meeting. We've had discussions with the jurisdictional committees on the 25th of February, and in those discussions, it was a very broad range of things that they have seen before in terms of service, bus, and rail routes, the riders who take those routes, the impact, the cost of those routes, the subsidy allocations to those. These are all materials that we have and we presented to the JCC. There was a lot of discussion. There was no real common direction, but there was good dialogue that was had, and good information was transferred to the JCC, which can be used to go back to their jurisdictions to have this dialogue on what service looks like, service modifications, service cost, and such. So on the rest of the schedule that I'm laying out for you today, talks about the criteria that I'll talk about in the next charts, which is a criteria that we have for bus, which is a policy, and I have Jack, which we'll talk about that a little bit. It gives you a framework for the timeline that we'll need in order to get where we need to go in June. And rather than putting dates other than the first two, I've tried to capture this in terms of cycle time and days. Just to give you an understanding, if we develop a docket, which we call a docket, and what is a docket? A docket actually is a materials that we're required to provide that is very comprehensive in terms of any considerations that we would like to have the public input on. And those dockets are very complicated. They can be very complicated. Last year we had a very complicated docket that went out to the public. We had a series of hearings, and it was just very complicated. But that could take about 20 days to do. There's schematics involved. There's mapping involved. There's all sorts of things. The board, of course, would have to authorize the docket. So there's an approval process that the board would have to take in order to authorize anything that we would go out to for the public to consider. And that would be a special board meeting, as I put here. At that stage, actually, there's work that goes that initiates based upon that input that is a Title VI analysis. We do that on a regular basis anytime we're looking at anything, whether it's fares or service changes or modifications. And that Title VI analysis is then analyzed based upon the docket content. And then there's a series of newspaper notices in order to give the public actually sufficient time so that they can see what the docket looks like and be able to participate in any input discussions you would want. And then you can see the rest of the days that go on. The bottom is a very broad time frame, which is 90 days. If there's any type of changes that would need to happen with regard to our current levels of service of bus and rail, it would be very significant, not just with moving our workforce around. We call that the PIC. A PIC would happen. There would be rider communications. Media and relations would have a very big task. Signage potential changes. So 90 days actually encompasses a lot of things, technology changes, if that was the case. And as many of you know here, last year we had a lot of technology implications with some of the fares that we had last year. So this is just to give you a framework in terms of the time frame that it would take to do any modifications and the requirements that we have under a compact to get public input. The next chart.
Question, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Downey.
Yeah, just tracing that timeline through, it appears to me September to October before you really could get anything done.
Well, it's it would be sometime, based upon the date that we're at now and where we are now, at this time frame, it's March, even if we had some type of a board direction on this in early April, it would be sometime in September to do this. So
any savings with respect to that will be diminished in the first year?
It would be diminished in the first year, in the first quarter. That's correct.
While we're on that, let me just comment on the public hearing that we're talking about here. In my mind, there are two separate issues that we as a committee and we as a board need to think about relative to dealing with the public on the budget. One of those is the overall question of this is our budget and these are the issues that we're looking at in trying to decide where to go with this budget, in which we can raise issues like, you know, what should we be doing about late night service and things like that? Should we be reducing bus service or rail service and broad issues like that? And the other is the legally required service change hearings, which are public hearings that are very structured and very carefully done. I think the two can run on totally different timelines. One of them is a more informal process, what I would consider a budget workshop with the public. And the other is a very formal thing that says we have to have defined exactly what we're putting in front of the public, what service changes there are, and make sure those go out in the very formal way and then act upon those. Those are ones where before we put them in front of the public, we have to make sure that each jurisdiction feels comfortable with the set of proposals that are being put out there. And this is the latter, not the former. And that says that we also have to be dealing with the other one, which is we have been saying that we do want to consult with the public on our budget, certainly sometime in the April or May timeframe. So just for everybody to bear in mind, I think those are two separate things, the things that need to be handled. And since I have the floor for the moment, and this is probably my last time that I'll be able to talk about this in the Finance Committee, I did want to note that among the options that are proposed, I really hope that this board will never choose monetizing of leases as a solution to a budget problem, which essentially creates a long-term problem by taking all the money that you're going to get over a long term and sticking it all in 1 year, and then you've created a major budget problem for the next year because you have that loss plus the loss of the leases for many years to come. And I also hope that we will never go to the point that we will have a Taco Bell station. And preventive maintenance, we've had long discussions on that. Anytime we have preventive maintenance as an element in the budget, it takes away from the capital program that we've just talked about that doesn't have enough money in it and enough track access rates. Please go ahead with the bus evaluation criteria.
Okay. So just to give you some context for the committee on the next chart, we do have a policy dated 2000 that our board approved, which is a policy on performance criteria for bus. And I have Jack here to discuss that a bit. And then we don't have one for rail, but I'll talk about the implications, the informal one that we have potentially for rail. But I'll have Jack speak about the criteria for bus.
Thank you, Carol. In the late 90s, in discussions with the and the results of the regional mobility panel and in working with the jurisdictions, service guidelines and criteria were established for Metro Bus, and these are on the chart. And these are based on annual numbers. So from each year since 2000, we had, as the ridership adjust or as the cost to run the service adjust, we adjust these criteria, and there's five. So I'd like to speak to them, and I'll try to do it quickly. On daily weekday passenger boardings, the threshold to meet the criteria is that you produce 1/8 of the system average for daily passenger boardings. The average of the system is 2,588, so the current threshold is 315. On a cost recovery basis, the system average is 29.75%, and the threshold for cost recovery for a route or a line is 14.85%. Average subsidy per passenger, the current average is $3.20 to meet the criteria. The line is expected to meet $6.40. Passengers per revenue trip, the average is 26.52. One-third of the system average is the expectation, and that number is 8.84. And on the passengers per revenue mile, the average is 3.42, and the threshold is 1.3, and the current threshold is 1.14 on an average. So every year we continue to recalculate these numbers and we evaluate all 166 lines that were in the system. These criteria, I can't recall them actually being discussed with the board over recent years, but they are discussed with the local jurisdictions, and decisions have been made to eliminate service as a result of low performance in some of these criteria. A couple examples, the C7 and C9 a couple of years ago. Several years ago, the N13, the N11 in the district. If those that recall the Smart Mover service from Bethesda to Tyson's, it was expected to be a good service. The performance turned out to be poorly, and based on actually the performance, the route was terminated. So we have 166 lines within the system. The number on the chart is correct, incorrect. We do have 37 lines that don't meet all five of the criteria. 23, there are two that don't meet any of the five, one that doesn't meet four, two that fail to meet three, nine that fail to meet two, and 23 of the 37 that only fail to meet one of the criteria. These services in total are worth about $30 million in operating costs, about $21 million in subsidy. We have evaluations on all of the routes, all 166, and we continually track this information and use it in our analysis of service, how it's performing, and, you know, certainly can be used in a factual and objective evaluation of the services if the committee so desires.
Mr. Rico, I just wanted to make clear what the policy, I think, says. The policy doesn't say if you don't meet the criteria, you're gone. It says these are the markers that say this is a route that requires consideration. And if I remember correctly, and what it does is highlight for us that staff first want to take a look at this and say, why are we running this service? And there can be lots of good reasons to run it when it's way below on all of those criteria. And then allow staff to look at those and say, what do we want to do, and make recommendations to the board and say, through the JCC, working with the JCC, and come to the board and say, here are ones that just don't quite make it, and C7 being one of those examples, and they're just not worth our continuing to operate, and then we go through the public hearing process to stop them. But it isn't like if they don't make it, there's something drastically wrong and we automatically get rid of them. What are the markers that say we better be looking at these?
Even in support of that, 10 of the 37 are routes that are public routes, but primarily are used for school services within the district that's fully subsidized by the district.
Okay, Mr. Downey.
Yeah. Once a route is identified, eliminating it is not the only answer. Correct. Well, that modifications would be considered.
These are not recommendations to eliminate any service. This is just informing the committee that we have criteria that evaluates these, and if these criteria want to be used in a process, we have that information.
I remember in the past we've sometimes said we'll do a marketing program for it, or we'll find ways to increase ridership.
Or reroute it, or whatever.
Right. All sorts of different things.
In terms of the work product needed to get to a hearing, I assume many of these are the same ones that have cropped up in the past.
I think that's fair to say.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So a lot of data would be there, maps and the like.
And there are reasons why, generally speaking, they haven't already had the modifications. Mr. Downs. Betty? Would you want to?
I looked for the criteria on the website, and I appreciate you saying that these were actually formulated in the late 90s and that the board has not had any discussion about the criteria, which means this is probably a little opaque to both the riders and probably the jurisdictions. A suggestion about making this more transparent, posting of the assumptions about the criteria for measuring bus performance, a little bit of a layman's explanation about how they got there and why they're important. That's part of our responsibility to the public, is making this information more accessible rather than as obscure as it is now. And I would also point out, I don't think we have any board criteria about any rail service in the system, and that that's a missing link here as part of a rational look at service evaluation, and I think it ought to be something that the board ultimately asks for, about some similar criteria for measuring rail system performance.
Well, and you're right about the rail, and we'll talk about that, but typical, in some transits, you're right, this is really a standard criteria that you use to level your performance services. And typically, if you're going to put the standards in place, they're going to link to your performance goals, ultimately up to the goals of the CEO of the board. So I think that the recommendation that we would make going forward would be that the board would be reevaluating the standards as set here. We would come up with a recommendation in terms of linking the performance standards, but there has to be something to be done with rail, because currently we don't have those listed as an evaluation criteria. I agree.
Ms. Hewlett.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, thank you for bringing to our attention and reiterating the point that this is a policy, that it's not an edict. that if a route fails to meet these five criteria, that it gets the heave-ho, so to speak. All the jurisdictions struggle, and I've struggled with this too every year since I've been on this board too. I don't think the criteria has come to the board as a board, but I know it is so integral to Prince George's County at least, and others' jurisdictions as well, that I have worked with the Department of Public Works and Transportation and also with the jurisdictional committees to make sure that this, because this would have been a travesty for Prince George's County. It would have been an absolute travesty. We would have lost the bus service in southern Prince George's County and also the Bowie State service, the B-30, I think it is, and B-30 to BWI and then the Bowie State. And I think that would have been catastrophic. Well, I know that would have been catastrophic, which brings me to another matter. I mean, this board tries very, very, very hard to ensure that we do not engage in or endorse wholesale service cuts. And, you know, I know every year that it comes up, and modifications that make sense, that reduce, you know, redundancies, that's, you know, we can work with that. But wholesale service cuts, didn't happen before. There were fights before, and I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. It would be a travesty for all our customers who need it and who rely on this just to get to work and to get wherever they need to go. So the other thing that Mr. Chairman pointed out was that, you know, there's two types of public hearings. And I don't know what the answer is, and I know I'm jumping the gun a little bit, but one of the first real heated, and not, they all seem to be pretty heated, budget sessions and committees that we had, we didn't put enough on the table. There were some options that we should have put on the table, and our customers were angry, and rightfully so, because I think we put the bare bones out there that year, and we foreclosed an option to them that, in my view, was very, I won't rehash everything, but in my view, was pretty reasonable, but it didn't get on the table. Then the next year, it seems like we went and put everything on the table, so it became so hard for anyone to discern what, you know, you needed a considerable amount of time to figure out what was actually being proposed, and it kept changing. So I hope we find a way to really fine-tune this before we put some sort of docket out that that isn't so difficult to understand, and that, you know, that doesn't encompass this wholesale service cuts and service reductions, because typically it doesn't happen, and all we do is get everybody all worked up, throwing it out there as though it's going to happen when we're going to do everything we can to ensure that it doesn't. So I hope we find some balance in that.
Ms. Porter?
I'm appreciating the point that because a route fails one or more of these criteria doesn't mean that it's necessarily axed, it's just looked at. Still, these criteria are fairly important in terms of even determining what we look at. I wonder if you could talk a little bit. Clearly the criteria were developed as proportions of an average. Could you talk a little bit about how those proportions, where did this first come from? Was it based on some best practices? Was it sort of based on looking at how the distribution of the various routes were on these criteria and some sense that you'd pick off the worst performing 10%, or?
I'm going to have to turn to Steph. I've been here a long time, but I wasn't involved in the process. Jim Hamry, Director of Planning, will help in this process.
And I guess I'm the designated old person in this case, in that I was here for the entire process. The guidelines really came out of the Regional Mobility Panel evaluations of 98, 99, when we were looking at how to restructure the finance and the service planning for Metro Bus in order to preserve it and really make it be able to grow through the future to meet the regional requirements. It did come out of a series of best practice evaluations that are documented in the regional mobility reports. The specifics were also reevaluated during the regional bus study, which was a comprehensive all systems, all jurisdiction effort that occurred during the early 2000 decade. And so these were the five bellwether criteria that we used to flag routes. And just to identify also in the board policy statement itself, there's a whole series of actions to improve service performance before termination that are identified for us to look at to be able to try and bring the services up above these performances. And last point is that they were really focused on the regional routes because there was a commitment beyond by all of the regional jurisdictions and funding partners to ensure that the performance of the regional network that Metro is responsible for meets the finance and the performance and the effectiveness thresholds that the jurisdictions insisted be met. And that was why we created the non-regional category, so that was totally the discretion of the jurisdiction.
For those of you that wonder about this continuing reference to regional mobility panel, in the late 90s, there was a serious move to make Metro a rail-only system and to have all bus service operated by local jurisdictions, and much discussion of that option. And so a large group of people from throughout the region, not just transit people, but political people and business people, and formed another one of these blue ribbon panels that looked at the issue of what should Metro really be and what kinds of service should it operate. And the decisions that were made at the end of that process were, number one, there are bus routes that are the ones that we today call the regional bus routes that provide access across boundaries and between major nodes, and a set of criteria were defined as to what made a bus route a regional bus route. And it was said that those routes should be operated by Metro because they were of regional significance and they mattered to more than one jurisdiction and they mattered to the economy of the region. You can look in the budget. I think it has the listing of what those criteria are. And then Metro was also told, but if local jurisdictions want to run additional service beyond those that qualify for regional, and they want Metro to run it for them, they can do that, and those are our non-regional routes. And so that's the origin of this whole set of discussions that we're talking about. Ms. Porter, did you have some more?
I appreciate that explanation, and I very much appreciate, since I don't know how many more times I'm going to be able to say this, but I appreciate the fact that you give those of us who are new background on all these issues. It is extremely helpful. And I wonder if I could just ask one follow-up question. Have you looked at what happens in terms of the number of routes that fail the evaluation criteria if you move the criteria one direction or the other just a little bit? In other words, how sensitive are these criteria? Is arbitrariness an issue?
Well, actually, when you array all of our services, which we do by order, and share that information with the JCC staff, there is a natural break in performance. So you'd have to have a substantial change in performance of these lines that show up on the list in order to get to the next level of services. There's a nice break in that.
So your sense is that these criteria are drawn at a place where they identify a real difference in service when you're arraying these things by these criteria.
But I'd like to add, one service that gets hit by this are express services, airport services, express services, because they don't carry a large. I mean, the X2 carries, hundreds of people on its trip. An express bus carries 35 or 40. So it has a tendency to be hard on an express trip because there's no turnover on a trip. So I think those are things that would be taken into consideration as you take a look at the potential for making changes.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Hedges, did you have something?
I guess I wanted to put the context in terms of looking at the criteria and then the decision-making process, because I think when we understanding the criteria and applying that criteria And then how do we make truly the objective decisions that the services that we're going to provide that become critical services that we think are to the public? But if we don't put the other end of this at the table, and that is, when we don't do that, what is the next option? And the next option is always, what we all know, is someone has to pay for it. And that's our customers or our jurisdictional pieces. And I think it's so important to have those at the table while we're looking at this, because it's very easy to say no or yes when it's said in isolation. So I think the opportunity to bring all of that into the same context of the discussion, because otherwise it is the tension builder that makes our discussion difficult during this part of the debate.
And I think it's also important to note that this evaluation, as staff have pointed out, is an ongoing evaluation. It isn't just part of the budget. And so one of the things that happens is very often we say, are our resources, even for bus, being used as effectively as they could be? And should we be taking some of our routes and cutting them back and putting that money into other services, which is one of the things we've done very recently? Ms. Hines.
I just want to circle back to the question of regional and non-regional. I understood that these evaluation criteria are about regional buses, or it's all bus service.
We utilize these criteria to evaluate all the services that Metrobus runs.
Okay.
If you go back to the specific wording in the policy, it's specifically directed toward evaluating the regional services to ensure that they're meeting the threshold expected by the jurisdictional partners.
Okay, but somebody, I think you, Mr. Requa, said that there are actually 37 lines that don't meet the criteria, 10 of which are fully paid for by DCPS or by the district government. So does that really mean there's 27 that are regional?
Not regional. No, it's a combination of regional. It's 27 that fail one or more of the criteria as defined.
They may not be regional.
They may not be regional.
Yeah,
they may
be a combination of regional and non-regional.
But the issue for us is about what are we going to subsidize that's regional, right? Because the definition of non-regional is we don't subsidize. The non-participating jurisdiction doesn't subsidize.
Well, I think the issue is, how do you want us to develop a program for you to meet your budget obligations? We run both regional and non-regional. It's all part of our budget. There are choices that need to be made. What kind of information can we provide you to facilitate that decision?
I guess
process?
I'm confused about who's paying for non-regional. I thought you said that was totally funded by the jurisdiction.
It is.
Correct. So that's a jurisdictional decision.
That's a jurisdictional, yes. When you're talking about, let me clarify maybe this. When we're talking about our increased subsidy, let's take that, because that's sort of like that's the base right now. We're talking about the bus criteria, the regional buses that don't impact, that don't meet that criteria, that standard, and that would impact under that subsidy. The non-regional ones are separately funded by each and every jurisdiction and are not included in that allocation.
So the $21 million that's here on this slide,
right,
goes directly to the subsidy question or closing the gap question. Is that correct?
I'll answer that in a minute. So the $21 million is a combination of regional and non-regional.
And we can provide you a listing of regional.
I think that's really important.
It is.
Again, we evaluate all service, even though the guidelines were for regional.
The issue there is that anything that is a regional route, we all save. But there may be a Fairfax County route that's in that set that you would want to look at and say Fairfax County would just assume, you know, reduce service or eliminate service on that route, so it affects budget.
And if it's a non-regional route, of route in Fairfax or route in Arlington, does it have the same hearing requirement as long as Metro is running it? But if I want to change my ART route, it doesn't matter.
If you have an Arlington County route that you want, that Metro is operating, we must go through the same public hearing process.
That's also helpful. Thank you.
Mr. Downey.
Yeah, with respect to the non-regional routes that are not run by Metro, are there similar criteria that the counties look at in managing their systems?
Each of the county systems do have performance criteria, and I know last year, Fairfax spent a fair amount of effort evaluating the services we run in the county against their internal standards.
And as the counties make their budget decisions, money is fungible. They can reduce some cost here. They might be able to pick up others.
At least in Virginia. Are there any more questions?
Do you have some more you want to talk about, rail?
Well, one, just a very brief. As I said, we don't have an established rail standard of service, and I think it's something to consider because it goes to performance standards that link to our performance goals. But we do look at informally, obviously, look at, you know, things that are the least impact to customers. Anytime we look at modifying service, duplicative service, and, of course, we have here the increased maintenance windows, but I think we had that discussion earlier today, and we have an action item on that. Two examples that we have here, specifically on the Yellow Line extension and the Shady Grove-Grosvenor short trip, and Dave can address any questions on that, but we just gave some examples here of some items that where if those services were eliminated, what types of subsidy savings and cost savings we would actually have, and the passenger impact. And actually,
I was just going to comment that these were requested specifically, so that's why we broke them out in the manner which we did.
Thank you.
Now, you have before us an action item, but I'm not quite sure what action we're going to take here.
Well, the action item that we have before is, you know, approval of the service criteria and the public input format or framework that you want, direction you want to give to staff. I mean, I've laid out the formal proceedings that would need to happen, the docket and that sort of thing, but I don't have a sense for how to build in the work sessions that the board wants us to do potentially in terms of public input. And so getting direction on that is.
Well, what I think I hear is that we have to at some point make two decisions. One, I think we did make, but we didn't put some time on it, and that's for what I called earlier a budget workshop. When is it that we talk to the public about the budget that we have before us and what we should be doing about it? And certainly we want that to be after we've had our next update on revenues, which I think is in April?
Yes.
Okay, so sometime after that, we might want to get together with the public and say, this is what we're facing, here are the options before us, what we're considering doing. It is an attempt to communicate with the public, but it does not meet any legal requirements. And the other one is, given that people may or may not want to look at, within each jurisdiction, reductions or modifications in service, particularly on bus, but there are a couple rail ones that have also been put out here, those would have to go to proper public hearings. And I think that's one where the JCCs needs to work, the individual jurisdictions need to work, and proposals need to be brought forward. And what you're saying is we need to do that fairly quickly or we aren't even going to make September.
That's correct.
Okay. So the question before this committee, I don't think there's any action that we can take at the moment, is how do we want to make sure that we can instruct our staffs to take a look at potential savings, bring them back to us, and bring them back to us in a time frame that would allow us to meet the September deadline, because we're not going to make the June one, and thereby see if there are ways to have additional savings. Is that something that we want to do individually with our individual jurisdictions? Or do we want to set a firm deadline and say, you know, speak now or forever hold your peace? That would not require, I think, a formal action, but Mr. Downs, you're leaning forward.
I hate to address this as strictly a budget issue. I think it's important about having clearly understandable, publicly accessible criteria, and I don't think they are, and that robs us of a bit of legitimacy. If we think that this is just a JCC issue, it is part of what we owe the public about this discourse, this dialogue about how we make these decisions. I would love to see plain English descriptions of each of the five criteria on bus. I'd love to see them online and accessible. I'd like to see a development of some rail service criteria, at least in draft form. They may not be completely useful in the budget process, but I think they make the budget process clearer.
Mr. Downs, yeah, I don't disagree with you. I just wanted to note that for the purposes of the budget, these criteria are not defining in any way other than to help us determine which routes we may want to look at and which lines we may want to look at. And what may happen is you look at a line and say, I like four of the five routes on that line, but there's another one that I really wanted to look at more closely and potentially do something about. Or I may also, as a staff person, and here I'm presuming this is the knowledgeable planners in each jurisdiction and the people on the JCC that either are or represent those people, may want to say, I have another line that I want to look at, even though it doesn't meet these criteria. That's well above it. But for some reason, it makes sense for us to look at that for modification. So what I think the staff is saying is, yeah, there are all of these things that go on, and they go on all year long. They aren't just now. And you're absolutely right. As we're doing that, the public needs to know that these criteria are out there that at least alert us to what to look at. But there is a separate question, which is, are we going to increase our subsidies? Are we going to cut services? What are we going to take some of these other options that have been put in front of us, such as taking money out of our capital program to run our operating program? All of those options are before us, and if any of us wish to take the service change as part of it, what staff is telling us is, now's the time to start figuring out what you're going to do, because pretty soon you won't have a chance to do it and affect the budget. Agreed. Agreed. Ms. Porter.
To add to that, I think that for me, the explanation of how we arrived at these bus criteria and how they act in relationship to the various lines was extremely helpful. And I wonder if some very short layperson's version of that could be included in the materials that Mr. Downs was talking about.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Downey.
Yeah, I would support that as well. And I think if we had that transparency, we wouldn't trap ourselves into the simple all service must be maintained, no service must be cut kind of discussion, really saying there are ways to get trade-offs and improve the overall quality of what we're doing.
Ms. Hines.
Mr. Benjamin, and I think relative to the question which is before us, which you've posed, which is, you know, we need to solidify a timeline of sorts. I think there are only four or five options the board has before it to deal with the $72 million gap that we have, and we all kind of know what they are. And so it would seem to me that to move this along, the best thing would be to have somebody come up with the solid timeline that's required, with actually a drop-dead date for people to put stuff on the table, so that we would at least know what that is. I don't know how else to operate in this environment, recognizing that we do want to do some more informal things in April and early May, which will help inform our decision, but that we need to put in place the option that lets us go out. Because am I right about this, Ms. Kissel? Things can be in the docket, and then the board can withdraw them?
Oh, yes. As Ms. Hewlett so indicated, we threw the kitchen sink in there last year.
But, I mean,
it doesn't have to be. The board considers based on the input.
Can we modify it before? I mean, can you write it all up, and then we say the day before we pull the plug on these five things, or?
Yes. Our history has been, as soon as it gets proposed for the docket, you get an awful lot of public reaction,
okay.
People upset.
Okay.
So you tend not to do that unless it's really serious.
Okay, thank you. Well, I mean, because our environment's slightly different at local government.
Yeah.
Sometimes you put it out and then,
And Ms. Kissel has tried several times to put deadlines in front of us. We just ignored
that's
them.
Why you were smiling. That's why you were smiling at me. Okay. I don't know.
I try to do it this time just to give you the cycle time and days, but I do have a calendar and I can, you know, submit it. But I think, and I'm telling you, I think that if we go out to hear that you want to do some of these meetings and discussions, work sessions in April timeframe, we will be in the September timeframe if that's the decision of the public and the board that we'll be modifying service. So we'll have to actually, what that actually does is it just puts more on the plate in terms of trying to, or I said another way, the gap might get bigger, right? Because you have to actually put more on the plate. So you have a bigger problem to solve. And you can solve it in several different ways, not just in service, but you can solve it in other ways as well.
Don't hear anybody moving towards any firm action at this point, but clearly we as a group have got to sit down and say, you know, by when are we going to get ready for public hearings, and that's a discussion that we have to seriously have.
I will say,
Ms. Hutchins.
There's one piece that's not in this calendar because it quickly moves to a special board meeting.
Yes.
And I don't think you're meaning a work session or a committee meeting. And I think today has provided a little bit more guidance, but I think it allows us to, if we simply make a meeting, which means a quick scheduling of us, to solidify calendars and then move forward. Mm-hmm. Because I think the most critical part is the transparency on the what and why we're going to go to the customers on. And they need to know what that is, and we don't want to allow a discussion that won't benefit progress for us making decisions. So, which says we need to do some more work in order to put things in front of our customers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that means that we need not a board decision meeting, but a board meeting that comes back with more information on what that is going to be. I don't think we can do, I can't see us getting there without. Today's decision will not give us enough.
I don't think we have a decision today.
Yeah,
we need to figure out by when we will all have decided whether we are going to have any, propose any service reductions. And if so, which ones, and feel reasonably comfortable that those are the ones that we are willing to put before the public. And that's both bus and rail. That's going to require work by individual jurisdictions and the board as a whole, because individual jurisdictions determine largely the non-regional routes and some of the regional ones, because some of them are heavily subsidized by one jurisdiction versus another, and then the whole board for regional bus routes and any rail issues.
I see two sets of dates here. I see us coming back to a committee meeting of some sort in a very short time frame. Mm-hmm. And in that, we have not only a committee meeting date, but we have some dates for a public input process.
Okay.
Because that gives you, it seems like it would give you a schedule of how to get to the drop dead date that's not into the far September time frame.
And part of that requires each of us as board members to go to our JCC people and say, how close are you and what will it take and when can we be done?
And I just guess.
Show
it. There's only one thing that drives the formal public hearing process, and that's changes in service, unless there's a discussion of fare increases. So we could be in a position, you know, on the much shorter time frame than Peter outlined, to present to the public, you know, why we have the gap we have to cover, the alternatives that we've proposed, which have been laid out to the board before, and then the one outstanding piece, which we could be in a position to discuss, I think, is if we did get into fair service changes, using the current criteria and the suggestions, what this would look like, which will draw a lot, based on my short history here, a huge amount of negative reaction. And then the jurisdictions are going to have to decide the balance between those service adjustments, these couple other things, and subsidy. So, I mean, we can have a much shorter discussion without the public hearing pretty quickly, I think.
Yes, we can. We have all the information.
So, you know, we can do that if the board is willing to move in that direction.
We have had in the past, as Ms. Hudgens is aware, and a lot of we've had committee meetings every week. We don't have to do that. I'm just suggesting that we don't have to. We can establish another committee meeting to have this dialogue.
We can come back to the committee. Maybe it's a special committee. Maybe we don't have to wait another month with a time frame, and we'll present in an informal session.
Right.
Okay? And that may guide you as to whether you even want to go to a formal public hearing in the future.
Well, I'm not hearing much support or objection
well,
either.
I'm hearing silence. Silence is golden.
Yeah, I think it's a reasonable solution to our short-term needs because I think, number one, these criteria have been in place for a while. It's basically going to illustrate the bus routes that are not performing as well, and that's factual because this is based on a long history of comparing the routes and whatnot. And also it's information for the board in that at that point, after discussions with the jurisdictions, you'll have a better sense of whether there's appetite or what the consequences are of any potential service changes. I think on a year-to-year basis, it's good to look at these things. You know, ridership patterns change over time, that our budget situation changes over the time, and we do need, as a matter of our obligation to the public, to make sure that we are providing the most the best coverage, but also the most cost-efficient services out there. And I think this is a very reasonable solution. I think there's a long-term discussion about the nature of service that this that we're able to provide over the coming years, just because of, you know, the outlook in terms of revenue and our budget situation. And what, we've had a lot of discussions about whether we can afford to provide, you know, services to everyone the way we we'd like to. But that's a broader board policy discussion that we'll have to have at some point. But I think in terms of trying to resolve this year's budget situation, I think Mr. Sorrells, I think, has a very good set of recommendations.
Well, I must admit that I'm in a difficult position because I won't be here to have to deal with the implications of it. But certainly in the past, I would have been very nervous about any action that would have put in front of particularly the people in Prince George's County, not so much Montgomery, a set of bus routes that have been rejected several times and other service options that have been rejected several times and have us go back and do it again. So just doing this as a blast of, well, these are the things that don't meet the criteria, what do you think, just creates that public uproar that I think is unnecessary and doesn't really help us very much. So I'm concerned about the simple answer. It has some substantial ramifications in terms of our credibility as a board with the public.
Mr. Chairman, which dovetails on what I was saying earlier, because it's very problematic to just send that out, and because everybody thinks it's a likelihood, or that it's a done deal almost, and the what we saw, you know, in the press, what we saw in the with the people who turned out at the public hearings. I mean, the elected officials who were calling us constantly because their constituents were complaining for something that we were going to do everything within our power to ensure did not happen. So it was very, very, very problematic.
Ms. Hutchins.
Mr. Reich, I think the point is that we've had these items put before us before, and I really think the decision that we're looking to, we should be looking to, is for us to really go back and do the culling of the list and do that ourselves.
Absolutely.
Rather than to do a blast. Because, and I was not being short-sighted when I made the comment before, the point that we're really discussing is if we do that, we are ready to make some hard decisions And those hard decisions are on both sides, the service cut or the subsidy payment. And so I think we're wrestling over how the community is going to react over service cuts when we need to be also reacting over the fact that if we don't want to hear that, we're making another decision. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's really important that we don't look at that by just simply saying we don't want to hear from the public. And so that to me is what I was trying to put in front of us so that we could go back and say, okay, we know we can frame this based upon the hard decisions we are going to make for our customers mm-hmm. and the hard decisions we're going to make in the jurisdiction. And maybe coming back at a committee meeting, the JCC, looking at that and working with the jurisdictions to say, okay, here's what we know. Any variances that are more this year than last year, what are those variances? And coming back with that decision, having now really put a map in front of us and look at a date to say we come back here.
I would think that's a very good way to move forward, and it would then mean that the detailed staff work would have to be done so that each of us can come to the table and say, this is the direction I would like to go, and this is what my jurisdiction can afford, and this is what what I'm willing to put in front of the public as a potential change in service.
Mr. Chairman, if I can follow up on Ms. Hudgens. Two things you said. First, we want to hear from the public. What we don't want to do is alarm the public if unnecessarily. But what I think what you have just, this is my view, my personal view, but what you have suggested is a key interim step, which makes all the difference in the world. So that, right, that I can support, even though there'll be somebody else supporting it. But that makes more sense because you can weed out and determine what's really viable in the respective jurisdictions, what they can afford. So that key step will make all the difference in the world so we can whittle it down the cuts and figure out what's affordable. So that I can support.
Ms. Hines.
Mr. Benjamin, I guess the other context piece that I think is important, and I hope I have not misunderstood this, is that we started out with almost $150 million gap, and that the manager has closed half of it with operational and other goals. And so when we go to the public, I believe we must start with that so that people understand the agency has stepped up and made commitments, and the jurisdictions in conversation with our customers are being asked to talk about what the way is to close the other half of the gap.
So do you want to try and choose a date that gives the jurisdictional staff and enough time to really look through all of the numbers and come up with some proposals for potential service adjustments and for us to deal with our staffs on what the alternatives are that we may want to look at and propose publicly? That's the question. Do you want to choose a date to do that, and how much time do you think that will take? At the end of that, we could get together and have a meeting and discuss.
Let me just add, in terms of the staff work that we would need to do, we could have that actually all the information prepared and ready in a week in order to provide that to the jurisdictions, regional and non-regional, impact and update as to what we had done last year, if there's any changes.
So it would be at least 2 to 3 weeks before we'd be able to have it digested and have decisions made and come back and say this is what we would like to go forward with.
It would give us the week of the 24th or 31st to come back here. And I would say the sooner the better, because that gives you the April time frame to hopefully get out to the public. And that closes your window a bit.
It does. Mm-hmm.
And I guess we would.
From my perspective, I'd prefer the 31st.
You're trying to get away. It's the 31st sounds like a more workable time for, I think, the jurisdictions to get the data, do their own analysis, and come back and respond. So if we can
we'll do that.
Propose the 31st and hope that everybody can make that the time that we come back.
So this would be another meeting of this committee and potentially a special meeting of the board to act on the actions of this committee, thereby moving everything quickly.
That's exactly right.
Okay. Is there,
that's a motion.
Oh, I don't think we need a motion.
We don't need a motion, just direction to staff.
Okay. Is that... Okay.
Any?
Are we seeing heads nodding in any particular direction over here?
The 31st at 10 a.m. or about then? Mm-hmm. 9 to 10 a.m.? Mm-hmm.
How long do you anticipate it will go? We're still in the midst of budgets at home, so I've got budget work sessions at home.
It's fine.
It's Thursday.
It's the morning. Can we solidify that time outside? Yeah. I don't think we need to say it at this table.
And if we can move it earlier, that'd be great.
Yes. 9 o'clock.
Okay, so we're talking about March 31st as the date.
And a time early in the morning.
And it would be two meetings, potentially.
It would convene into a
finance meeting. Committee followed by board.
Yeah.
Do we need a motion for that? No.
I don't think we need
Okay, a fine. So let's move on to Metro Access and see if we can move this quickly. We've done all the easy stuff. Now comes the hard stuff.
I don't know. It's so much.
Mr. Kent?
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Oh, look at that. Mr. Kent has got a formal, carefully printed card there in front of him.
I've arrived.
You have arrived. Okay, Mr. Kent, go ahead.
Good afternoon. My presentation is an update for the board on the financial aspects of Metro Access. And, of course, those of you who have been on the board for a little while have reviewed this type of report in the past. What makes this one different is that the program itself has actually reached several milestones. And so I want to clarify before I begin that the title says that it's a cost management plan. This is not a new plan. This is the program that we have been operating on, and so I'm actually here to provide some good news and some results of our cost management efforts, as well as to touch on some of the milestones in the program, which include coming to the end of the class action legal settlement. There is also a critical juncture in the operating contract, and then I also wanted to take a moment and touch on where staff recommends that we take the program beyond those milestones. I also wanted to take just a moment to talk about the fare increase, because this is the most recent development in the service. It was successfully implemented on February the 27th, and I wanted to reiterate that this was not a new action, that actually this was part of the approved FY11 budget, and it was known at the time that because of the technological complexity of changing the scheduling and fare calculation system, that it was going to take additional time for Metro Access to be able to make this change. And we did that successfully on the 27th. It was also part of a larger discussion that the board had last year about the fact that the program has experienced extraordinary growth and that had reached a point where it had become unsustainable. And this was one part of a series of actions that were taken to help contain the demand of the service. And so, again, just recently implemented, it was also part of a realignment of the service area to the ADA definition, which, as you know, is the three-quarter mile corridor. Part of the fare increase was implemented immediately on July 1st, which was a 50-cent flat rate increase. Now, it is twice the equivalent fare that the paratransit customer would otherwise have taken on bus or rail. At this time, I'm not really in a position to make any specific forecasts about the impact financially of the fare increase, because there's not really been a lot of information out there about paratransit elasticity, but I have made a commitment and have forecast that it does appear that we will be able to finish this fiscal year on budget, which is something that was pleasing to many. Now, I can quickly move through this. Most of you know the history of the program. There's been, again, extraordinary growth in the ridership for a number of different reasons. Some of it has to do with the fact that we've invested heavily in service quality. Some of it is because other providers of this type of service have folded or significantly curtailed the service that they provide, and so more and more customers have been coming to Metro. Over the years, as that demand increased at such high rates, Metro has had at several junctures been forced to catch up. And as a result of that, in 2004, there was a class action lawsuit that was filed. It was mostly pertaining to on-time performance. Since that time, the lawsuit was settled, and I'll provide some additional detail on that. In 2006, the current contract began. With MV Transportation, we went from a mostly manually operated service to one that has a great deal of technology. 4,500 trips scheduled by hand, today 10,000 trips scheduled by a computer. Previously, no GPS on the vehicles. Now our fleet is equipped with GPS, which allows us much greater tracking and reporting capabilities. All of that technology integrated with the phone system, customers get automated calls that keep them advised about, yes, you have a reservation, or yes, your ride has come, or heads up, your eligibility is going to expire in 60 days and we need to make an appointment with you. All of these things have resulted in improvement of service for the customer, and unfortunately or fortunately, that also translates into even further increases in demand. Today, we have adhered to the contract performance standards, and we can now boast that the program is actually at a five-year high on customer satisfaction, and that is measured as a number of complaints per 1,000 trips requested. I mentioned the legal settlement. It officially ends on July 2nd of this year. As we speak, the last of a series of reviews of the compliance with the settlement, both in terms of meeting the contract standards as well as our data integrity, the last one of those reviews is currently underway. And I put this into the presentation just to point out that we're not quite finished. As the legal settlement comes to a close, one of the things that we want to emphasize is that Metro intends to continue to abide by these same performance standards, and that there is no intent to pull back on the commitment to the customer, because once the settlement passes, then, you know, again, that opens us back up to further discussions about service if it were to change. We've talked a little bit about the way that the contract is set up in terms of cost, and there were some concerns that perhaps that the cost of the contract was increasing irrespective of ridership. I want to very much correct that misperception, that 80% of what we pay to the contractor is directly driven by ridership, and the other 20% is fixed cost. Now, one thing I'll say about the fixed cost is I think in the next contract we probably would revisit what we have in fixed and probably move more of it into the variable rate component of the contract. But presently, it's mostly staffing and technology that's in the fixed cost component, and that's about, of the annual expense, about $12 million out of our budget versus the $92 million that is directly related to ridership. I have on this slide a comparison of the cost per passenger that we have here at Metro, $41 presently. It has not changed much over the years, but it is slightly higher recently. And again, this was a point of clarification. We do not adjust the contractor's rate in anticipation of them being able to handle more ridership. What we do is we allow the contractor to continue operating with the rates that they've been given until it reaches a point where it's not tenable any longer. Then the contractor comes back, or we have a discussion and say, you know, are the ratios of staff to demand what they should be? And so we make the adjustments after the fact. The last time that we did that was last year, and it was because the most recent statistics that we had on annual growth were that in FY09, it was a 22% annual increase. In FY10, it was an 11% increase. And so with that history, we increased the infrastructure. But what has happened, I think we'll move on to that, is that at the same time, we've been working on demand management. We've been travel training people. We have expanded the promotion of fixed route use by people with disabilities in our eligibility process. And so now what we're seeing so far for the first half of FY11 is that it is only a 3% increase over the previous year. So the good news is our demand management efforts are working. And so now what's appropriate is for us to have another discussion with the contractor again, that now the adjustment should come in the other direction. And so one thing that I wanted to just share right off the bat is that the numbers that were shown previously on the FY12 budget indicated that we wanted to have a $13 million increase over the previous year. That information was produced last summer based on the prior history. And where we are today with this new information, I'm pleased to say that we're going to be able to adjust that number downwards significantly. But our demand management efforts have made a substantial impact in the cost of the program.
Mr. Kent, let me stop you for a moment. That's good news. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we all love the idea, particularly those of us in Maryland that pay a large percentage of that cost. but one of the things I also would note is this board took some very, very difficult actions and made some difficult decisions in order to have demand management work, some of which, as you pointed out, have only recently come into place. And so we would expect this trend to continue.
Yes.
And potentially have even greater savings. When I go back one page here and I look at the nice numbers that you've given us of comparison, mm-hmm. We have a general manager who comes from New Jersey Transit who is apparently able to run paratransit service at less than $20 a trip, and we're at over $40 a trip. Can you give us some sense as to why there are those kinds of differences?
I'm glad you asked that. I'm going to answer that question. Yes.
Any of you can choose to answer.
Well, when we talk about the cost of paratransit, I have mentioned this before, there are a number of different measures that you can use to look at the program. And one of the things that I've cautioned is that as the social service agencies have moved their demand to us, what you could say is that if we bring a much higher level of ridership into the program, we could bring our cost per passenger number down, but the overall cost of the service would be higher. So I think in some of the other systems that we compare ourselves to, a lot of it has to do with the density of service that's being provided, the size of the service area, whether or not they're serving multiple purposes or whether they're just ADA paratransit, whether they're a large major metropolitan area like we are, you know, in which case we have a larger infrastructure that's necessary to produce the same service quality that's required under the ADA to meet that level of demand. So the reason why I use this number is not because I'm trying to say, gee, we should try to become like New Jersey Transit and bring the cost down to $17. It's more that this is an array of cost per passenger across many transit agencies. And if you were to stop the line just above SEPTA, and you were to average systems that are more comparable to us in terms of size and service characteristics, the average really is more in the high 30s, low 40s numbers. So we're really not that far out of where we should be for a system of the size and characteristics of WMATA.
The one factor that you gave us was basically density of service, number of riders. As one of the big explanations. Now, I suspect that our numbers aren't dramatically off some of the other major cities, are they?
No.
So why is it that they managed to, I mean, you know, even $10 a ride is a pretty substantial contribution to subsidy. Mm-hmm. Why is it that they are able to do it for $10 a ride less than we are?
Well, again, I mean, there are many different service characteristics. There's some areas like Los Angeles, which is enormous, but the way that they deliver service is very decentralized because they're covering a very broad service area. And so if you have people taking short trips in disparate parts of a large region, that's one cost. If you have a more concentrated service area where people are taking long trips, and in our case, our average trip length is about 13 miles. You know, that is going to have an effect on your cost. So travel patterns are going to matter. Trip length is going to matter. You know, and again, whether or not you're serving multiple constituencies is going to matter. Are we mixing ADA with non-ADA service? All of those things are factors in these numbers.
Well, I would like to encourage you to look at some of those factors, like, you know, why are we doing 13-mile trips on the average, which is a pretty long trip in this metropolitan area, and what can we do, given the tools that have now been provided with some of the hard decisions that the board has been making, to encourage people to maybe use our fixed services more, which is one of the things we've been trying to move towards, or see why those trips are occurring at such a great length.
Certainly, and I would just respond that one of the things, we want to answer that in two ways. First, we would like to come back at a future meeting, if we can, to talk about the success of travel training and the dramatic increase in the use of the fixed route services. I think that's important. But the other thing is, that if I could just give one example, what Mr. Benjamin is referring to is that by narrowing the service area to just the ADA definition, and by allowing us to move into a phase of eligibility where it can be conditional, that people use paratransit only in certain circumstances, the next step would be to say, and so in those circumstances where you are not needing paratransit, we're going to refer you to the fixed route system, or we may take you past a barrier on paratransit to the nearest bus stop or rail station to complete your trip. Presently, the program doesn't have that type of transfer, but that's part of what we would look at in future business models. So I return to this slide. This is the really good news that we are adjusting downward our FY12 proposed budget for Metro Access by $4 million. And that is the position we're taking right now just based on the impact on ridership growth alone that I've mentioned this afternoon. The other part of that, though, is the contract right now with our transportation provider ends on June 30th. And one of the things that we have to decide is how to proceed from that point. The contract does have one more option on it that is 2 years in duration. And the recommendation that we have is that we should exercise that option, but not with the understanding that we're buying 2 more years of no change and no result, but rather to say exercise the option because it's Metro's unilateral right to do so. It locks in the rate structure that was committed to some time ago. And then as we approach the contractor to negotiate and try to fine-tune the price, we're working downward from that locked-in rate rather than concerning ourselves with transition costs or any of the other issues that would be associated with a contract turnover coming so soon. And it's going to take staff some time to produce an RFP that would include some of the changed service model designs that we've been talking about, and we would want to do that by thoroughly vetting that with the community, with prospective bidders, and also to pursue varying funding sources to raise the discussion again about coordination with other regional resources. We also have, again, the fact that the legal settlement is coming to a close. And that is certainly a focus of my team as we finish this fiscal year. Then what we would do is, in FY12, immediately begin with the construction of the new RFP. Part of that work in the coming year is going to be approached by a number of different avenues. That one is that Metro staff is working internally on its own cost analysis, looking at ways that the contract could be tweaked, that service could be delivered in a different way perhaps. I've been working with our CFO We have outside parties who are looking very objectively at the contract as a commodity, just simply to say, okay, well, if we isolate certain goods or services that are part of that contract, could we perhaps use certain leverage to improve those parts of the contract, as well as to change it to a design that really is more performance-based, that, you know, the compensation would be directly tied to a number of goals. Presently, most of those goals are qualitative, and I think we would place more emphasis in the next model on quantitative. But those are the types of things we've been doing. And again, also, as I mentioned, vetting with the various stakeholders, that's going to be very important to ensure that people have a chance to weigh in on this very important service.
Question, Mr. Downey.
I recall from the discussions last year that the goal and the direction we were moving in was to go forward with a new contract this year. Now we're hearing keeping the existing contract for 2 years is our best move. And I'm just wondering how things have changed, how that outlook has changed, or has my memory failed me?
Well, I can only say this, Mr. Downey, that I have personally not said that myself, that I thought that we should immediately go to a new contract design, because one of the responsibilities that I have is to work with the procurement staff to put a timeline together and that sort of thing. But what I do know is that in the past we have referred to the fact that in a future contract that there would be the possibility to make scope changes.
But that future contract is always receding into the future at this point.
Well, again, I think what's changed, though, is that we're coming to you now with new data that says that with the demand management coming back down, with the ability to lock in prices, and given the fact that right now, I mean, one thing I have to say is that we have only a few firms that are qualified to bid on the service. So if they come in, you know, one of the possible outcomes in going on the street is that all the prices would be higher. So if we already know that demand is coming down, that 80% of what we're paying currently is demand-driven, that our efforts are working, that, you know, it's not quite so urgent at this point to try to make the change. And, you know, the other consideration is that we want the transition to be smooth for customers. So I'm pleased to have the opportunity to do it in more of a deliberative fashion.
If we were to decide that the right option is to re-procure, have we already passed the point where that's a real option?
Yes.
Yes. This was not presented to us, but it's presented to us as a fait accompli.
Well, I'll say this. That was not the intent, but I will say that in discussing the priorities over this fiscal year, that knowing that legal settlement was coming up at the end of this fiscal year, and given the fact that also a lot of effort during this year so far has been focused on the successful execution of that fare increase, which involved a lot of negotiation, a lot of testing, it's a lot of change to put the customer through all at one time. And so we've tried to take this one piece at a time.
And if we are going to exercise the option, and as I read the presentation, attempt to make some improvement negotiations as part of that, I certainly would want to know what our goals are and be able to measure whether we've achieved them. Not that we have at this point any other option that I can think of, but I don't think we should just accept the inevitable.
I think you have a request there to come back to the committee with proposals for what goals you're going to try to reach and which areas you think you can reduce the costs.
That might be to come back to the board, because I think it would be an executive session discussion.
Okay. Ms. Hudkins, did you have something?
No, that was just it, that I think Mr. Downey's point is very well taken. I think the point that he stresses is that the discussion has been the timetable of the contract option, not a closure to that. And I think there was the anticipation until recently that was the discussion that it would move forward. But I think the most important thing is that we see what those adjustments and performance measures are going to be so that we really can be prepared to come back to the best negotiations and then the best options are going out.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Are there any other questions for Mr. Kent? Thank you, Mr. Kent.
Thank you.
The next item on the agenda, I just want to note, come June,
The board will be asked to approve a $2.4 billion budget. About $1 billion of that $2.4 billion is the capital program. We spend all our time focusing on operating, but out of the $2.4 billion is capital. Our one and only presentation on the capital program, I believe, is the one coming up. I don't think we have one scheduled for any time in the future. Okay. So in the few minutes we have left, let's look at $1 billion worth of what we're going to be asked to approve in June.
Well, actually, we could certainly come back and have future discussions, and I know we have sort of a short window here. I'm going to have Matt Brown take you through the highlights, so and maybe not page by page, unless the committee would like us to go page by page. Please let us know.
Ms. Hines?
Mr. Chairman, I just, looking at the time of day and knowing that governance is scheduled even later than this, I just wanted to offer a suggestion to deal with governance, which might, I don't know about anybody else, but I'm extremely hungry, and when I'm extremely hungry, I have a hard time following. So I'd like to suggest that we move our governance meeting to that March 31st meeting that we've just talked about adding, just add that 1 hour for governance there, skip it for today, with a request to my colleagues to particularly look at the board responsibility and chairman responsibility and send me any major comments you have by email, and then that'll let us kind of keep moving along. And I don't know then if we could break and eat for a half an hour and come back, or whether we just want to keep plowing along. But I'm just putting my own, the hunger
thing.
Can
I give some other options as well? I mean,
give us some other scheduling
options. Yeah, so here's other scheduling options. Now, we've in the budget book, we have a very detailed, a transparent, accountable, mm-hmm. you know, view of our capital program. It's online. We've actually done annual work plans, which we provide in detail to the jurisdictions. So nothing here is going to be a surprise. That said, we can actually definitely do this presentation at next month's FA committee if you would like to have a more robust discussion on it, so we can move it, is what I'm suggesting, as an option. Or we can certainly continue on and have it today. So
I do believe that there are a couple pieces of this that would be extremely important to do today, in particular the first few pages and whatever lead-in you can do to page 77, which is a very critical one at this moment. We don't have to go through all of the attachments and stuff, but
so we can.
I think, yeah, explaining the basic budget and at least getting us through those pages, I think, would be very useful right now, because 3 weeks from now may be too late.
It's a timely event, yes. Okay.
Right. So. I'll do my best to do that, and I'll start with page 72, with your permission. What we've tried to do with the implementation of the capital funding agreement, as you know, we've really transitioned from an expenditure-based program, I'm sorry, from an obligation-based program to an expenditure-based program. And what we are trying to do is transition all of our programs. These are the major four elements. These are the four elements of our capital program. The largest, of course, is the CIP. That's what's funded off our FTA formula funds, the PREA funds that we'll talk about in just a second. That's 80% of the program. But there are three other elements. The stimulus program, of which $42 million is anticipated to be spent next year. Reimbursable projects, and the big one there is the Dulles project. And finally, safety and security grants. We received about $60 million, and we're spending out those funds. Again, these are the estimates of expenditures. So right now, it's estimated that we'll spend over $1 billion next year on these programs. Again, 80% on the CIP, 851 at the top of that page. We do lay out in the next few pages a financing plan. We show the differences in FY11 forecasts and FY12. Proposed budget for various categories of projects for each of those four elements. We can go into some of the details in the future. I think, Mr. Benjamin, what you want to touch on is on page 77, and that's risks to the financial plan. And as you're aware, there is a significant risk. Right now we face the possible loss of not only the $150 million in PREA dollars, but the additional local match of another $150 million. That would cut $300 million out of the $850 million program. It would be devastating to the capital program and that the work that we're trying to do. The customer impacts are listed there: frequent train delays, worsening reliability, deteriorating station conditions, longer lines, poorer experience for our customers. This work is across the spectrum. I mean, work to prevent broken rails will slow. Switch repair equipment will not be ordered. Track fasteners that help prevent electrical sparking would not be replaced. We would have to defer equipment for monitoring trains. We would have to, rather than ordering 100 buses, we'd only be able to order about 25, which would have impacts, maintenance cost impacts. It would have impacts on our customers. We would not be able to reconfigure the Bladensburg shop to expand maintenance at the Southern and Royal Street garages. Our stations, annual work that's done for deep cleaning, including platform and ceiling tile repairs, would not be performed. Station water leaks would not be addressed. The list goes on and on, and it's a significant impact. I don't know if Mr. Kubitschek or Ms. Kissel would like to expand on that any further. But
it's 40%. So when you think about it, it's really cutting 40% of a very critical capital program that is going to be very difficult to recover from.
Not anything else to add other than the other thing is the risk of this is any major contracts that we already have awarded, and if we were to have to halt that money, then there might be potential loss of funds where we have to pay out of a penalty to cancel a contract as well. That would be another byproduct that hasn't been discussed very often.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. McKay.
We need that list. You said the list goes on and on and on. That's what we need, and that's what the board has asked for in previous meetings, that if not this money, what does that mean?
We have provided that list last week, and we can resend it. It has this list that he's reading from.
The list that you're reading from, mm-hmm. in the context of the $300 million.
Yes.
Okay, because that is what we need to be critically.
We can resend that today.
Would you resend it?
Definitely.
Yes. Ms. Sullivan just walked in the room. You may want to repeat all that for her.
I think Regina knows, yes. We'll send it. No problem. And I do agree that's what you.
What's also not included, or the second bullet is another risk to funds, certainly not as big as the 150 or the 300 million in PREA, but our FTA formula funds from the current fiscal year to next fiscal year, our assumption is that federal formula funds will remain constant. We don't know what the long-term outlook is for federal formula funds, but there's certainly some risk in that area as well. And that's not addressed by the list that you'll receive.
So one of the things that you're telling us is that we used to have increases in the amount of federal formula funds.
Approximately 6% a year, right, over the last several years.
And about 6% a year. We've already taken that out of our budget for the next couple of years.
That's correct.
Which already is constraining our budget, and meaning that the quality of service that we're going to be able to provide to our passengers, which we're hoping to increase and improve, may or may not be able to be improved. Is that what you're basically saying?
That's
given all of this?
Correct. That's correct.
So we're now looking at the potential that we may not be able to replace or rehabilitate escalators that will take care of the safety needs, but we won't do the reliability pieces that we really, really need.
That is correct.
How about things like the rail car contract? Are those ones that
that's
we
a safety built? Issue, and so far we're okay with that.
So we will go with the rail cars.
Yes.
But it's the day-to-day. You think you got a problem with escalators now. If we don't have this, we aren't going to be able to improve, and we may not even be able to hold our own.
On-time performance will go down. Escalator availability will go down. The stations will be dirtier. Customer information, which we always like to focus on and improve, will deteriorate. You name it, this is not going to be as good experience on the system.
Okay, Mr. Downey.
But it'll be safe.
Sean, if I could just comment on the President's budget, which was submitted, which calls for a 128% increase in transit funding over the next 6 years, with a very substantial portion of it dedicated for state of good repair work on rail and bus systems. If that were to be enacted, we would not be talking about these issues, but that's clearly a function of what the Congress is going to do and how the money is found to pay for that. But the intent is there to substantially step up the level of public transit investment.
So you're saying the administration has recognized these kinds of needs and would like to even accelerate our attempt to deal with it and every other transit agency?
They said they would like to enter into discussions with the Congress on how to pay for it. In addition, they have asked to continue the $150 million special metro contribution.
And we are faced with the potential of actually taking steps backwards as opposed to those that are being proposed to move us forwards. Are there any other comments on this? Okay.
I would just mention that in accordance with the capital funding agreement, we've been providing, I think, a lot more detail than we have in the past. In December, we provided this document, which was the annual work plan. I think it has a page for every single project. And then, of course, there's a lot of detail in the budget book. We won't get into the individual projects. Some of the jurisdictions, in accordance with the agreement, have submitted questions that we're working to respond, individual project questions, and we will provide those answers. We can address the details of the capital program at a future meeting.
So we've just done our $1 billion in 10 minutes. Now, I do think that this probably does need to be revisited in a little bit more detail at some time in the future. Absolutely. Between now and when the board's asked to approve it. But really the critical issue is we don't know how much we're going to likely have next year, and it could have a major effect on our ability to do the basic things that we spent most of this meeting talking about.
And finally is the monthly financial report. We've revised the slides after the comments we received.
Let me stop you for a second because Mr. Pauls, I think, before we got to that, wanted to say something.
There's one other key component here that is within our control, and that is the demonstrated capacity to deliver the capital program. We are judged fairly or unfairly on the basis of the execution of this capital program. Any misses, any delays create vulnerabilities for this authority on the Hill. It goes without saying that we have to control the things that we can control, and that is our continued ability to expend the capital that we've got.
Mr. Brown.
Well, actually, with that as a segue, maybe I'll do the capital update, and Matt can give you the good news on the operating subsidy. But we are going through a very big change. We have a big capital program this year, much, much bigger than in any prior years. There's a ramping up, and we've done a lot of things to do that. We've have a PMO that we brought in and all those other things. So I will say, year to date, we've actually increased our obligation rate from the prior year by 10%. So we're at an obligation rate of about 72% of our capital program versus in the 60s last year. That's a very big improvement. In terms of expenditure rates, we're right now on target where we were last year. Dave expects that to ramp up as we get into spring and summer. So we're looking forward to the improvement that we're going to have next year, and we've always known that it's going to be a two-year period to ramp up to a steady state when you're going to $1 billion, really doubling your program. So,
with regard to the expenditure rate, the base is much larger this year than it was last year. So while we have a comparable expenditure rate, the thing is that the amount of money actually spent is 50% greater this year at this time of the year than it was last year. And as Carol mentioned, at the same time we're trying to get things out the door, we're also trying to create the organizational infrastructure to manage a program at the same time. So we're running in parallel, and hopefully within another year or so we'll kind of match up together. Yeah, so we'll produce better.
Thank you. As an important point, $191 million last year, year-to-date spending, we're now at almost a $300 million rate. So it's a much higher expenditure rate. Thank you for that. So, and then Matt will give you the operating news.
There's also the potential that if we don't get the money that we're looking for, that building up that capacity won't have done us any good, and we'll have to get rid of some of those people and do it all over again at some time in the future.
That's our message.
So if I could switch to the operating, as I mentioned, we've revised the slides, and I think these are easier to understand and present the message. Year-to-date, we're on budget. We're actually ahead. While our revenues are $20 million below budget, expenditure items through aggressive management of the program are $30 million below budget.
The major drivers are listed there. We've had some savings, fringe benefits, services, big savings year-to-date on propulsion and diesel, as well as utilities, that makes up the $30 million. We do have some unfavorable items. We've talked about the overtime issue in previous meetings, a slight negative variance on supplies for some unanticipated items, such as lighting and brake repairs. All in all, though, we're in good shape in the operating budget. The next few slides show the ridership information as was requested last time. On rail ridership, as you can see, we are really holding our own. We're down year-to-date against the budget by just about 1%. We took a little bit of a hit in January with some of the snow days, actually the days that followed the snow days when I think businesses were still closed, some schools were still closed. So that's where we are on the rail ridership. This next slide shows the bus ridership, and you can see the story that we've been talking about since the beginning of the fiscal year with bus ridership below levels last year and below our current budget. So we're down 6%, which is what we've been since the beginning of the year. Those are the highlights from the financial report. Ms. Kissel talked about the good news on the capital budget, or some of the progress that we've made. And, of course, all the details that are normally provided are in the packet.
Could I just assume that the various ups and downs, the sine curves that you've got there, the variations for December, January, and February between last year and this year are primarily the effects of snow and closed services last year and this year?
Absolutely. It's very pronounced in bus for February as well as rail for February. It's exactly that's the snow, the impact of the snow.
Are there any other questions? If not, that brings us to the end of our agenda. And
Mr. Benjamin?
Ms. Hewlett?
I'm sorry. I hate to be the one to come between this board and food, especially at this late hour, but there's something I have to say. And if you would just indulge me for a few minutes. As most of you know, the governor and the county executive, Sharon Baker, earlier this week announced the two replacements in Maryland for Prince George's County, the two being Alvin Nichols as the principal director and Artis Hampshire Cowan as the alternate. And although my term was up in June, I agreed to stay on until those replacements were appointed. And when I entered here today, wasn't sure about the confirmation process or whether I'd be here next week or not. It appears that this is it for me today. So today's my last day, and I would be remiss if I didn't say thank you to an awful lot of people. And I'll try to condense that because I know, you know, you have to eat. So, as a matter of fact, Ms. Hines, I even asked if they had some crackers or something for you. But I first want to thank Governor O'Malley for appointing me to this position and allowing me to serve. I've learned so very, very much, and it's an honor to serve. It's a challenge to serve, but it's an honor to serve as well. But for the difficulty in balancing my day-to-day profession, which is a very small business, which I have to be a part of, I would still be on this board. But I found it very, very, very difficult to balance those competing things. But I decided to give my all while I was here. And I've enjoyed it, and I've enjoyed the many people I've worked with. And I'd first like to, after thanking the governor, I'd like to thank the board members with whom I served, which were Jim Graham, Chris Zimmerman, Neil Albert, Dana Kaufman, Emeka Maname, Gordon Linton, and Marcel Solomon. Those are the ones who have departed with whom I've served. And I'd also like to thank John Cato, who was a great general manager and with whom I served too. And then turn to Mr. Sarles, who our general manager, CEO, who's just phenomenal. And I have such a comfort level in knowing that you're there as the CEO, GM, and that I feel like we're really on the right track. Lord knows we've had a number of challenges, but I think we are really turning this ship around, or turning this train around, and I think that we have a lot of things, even though we still have challenges to come, I still think that we have a lot, that we've done a lot, and I feel really secure that we're headed in the right direction. I'd like to thank, first of all, Carol O'Keefe as general counsel, Helen Liu, and all the people who stepped up as board secretary, not just Loida. Loida and Nicola and Denise and John and all the WMATA employees, the bus and rail operators, police officers, Chief Taborn, all the station managers, professional administrative staff, safety staff, media relations staff, you know, everyone, the executive leadership committee too, Gary Baldwin, Nat Bodenheimer, Andrea Burnside, Jim Doherty, Christian Kent, Carol Kissel, Dave Kubicek, as I said, Carol O'Keefe, Shiva Pant, Suzanne Peck, who just left, Jack Requa, Barbara Richardson, and I said Chief Taborn. The Riders Advisory Council and Frank DiBernardo, the Accessibility Advisory Committee, the JCC, who worked so very, very hard, the Transit Oversight Committees, Jim Benton, George Good. I have to thank MDOT. I have to thank not just John Picari, who I worked with extensively, who's now the Deputy Secretary of Transportation, but also Beverly Swaim Staley, who's just done a superb job and as Transportation Secretary in Maryland, and her staff, Fred Rappi, who left and may be back, and Andy Scott, Kristen, who I saw a second ago. Kristen Tolles. And where would I be without Tom Webster? Special thanks to Tom Webster, who's just been very, very faithful. I'd like to thank the county exec, the Department of Public, county exec, Sharon Baker, the Prince George's County Council, Department of Public Works and Transportation, Haitham Hijazi, Jim, everybody, Vic, Rick Gordon, and Lou Farber, who's here regularly on a faithful basis. The people that I deal with on a regular basis, like Matt Brown and Jim Hamry and Jim Hughes and Charlie Scott, Tom Harrington, and Steve Golden. I gotta thank Local 689. Don't always agree. We're not always in sync, but they play a fundamental role for WMATA, so I have to thank them as well. I just think they do a superb job, and I hope that we are more in sync in the days to come. The employees who are highlighted each and every month in the employee spotlight for their heroic and acts beyond the call of duty, but also the unsung heroes who go about their work every single day and go beyond the call of duty, and we may not know about it. So thank you to them as well. And, of course, Denise McMillan. And thanks to Mr. Orleans, who comes and challenges us every week, every WMATA meeting, and we don't always agree to see eye to eye either, but he challenges me, and I count on that, so thank him too. Also, the riders, all the many, many customers who, be they the frequent riders, the regular riders, the occasional riders, or the ones in the lifetime tourists. So I think, we're very, very thankful to them as well, and I am in particular thankful to them as well. We've had, other people have left now. So many people have left that they've highlighted our challenges and they've highlighted our successes, so I won't go through all of that because, I'm very pleased with the successes that we've had, and the challenges are here. We've addressed some of them. We continue to address the others. I'm thankful for all the governance people who have undertaken to study us, and they are a lot. There are a lot of them. And then, of course, I get to this current board, who I just think is so engaged, so intelligent, so engaged, so committed. So I thank all of you as well. I get choked up. That's who I am. You're thoroughly, thoroughly, thoroughly committed. And I think with this board and those who are getting ready to be appointed from Prince George's County, you're really, really, really in good stead. And then I have to thank my Maryland counterpart, Peter. Peter Benjamin has just done such a great job and so superb as chair during a very, very difficult year that my hat's off to you. It's been a pleasure serving with you. And then, who else I want to thank? I think that was about it. Oh, but I have every confidence in this new board, and particularly with the inimitable Ms. Hudgens at the helm. I think you're going to do a really, really great job. So I'm always a phone call away. I'm going to continue to ride the system. I wish you all Godspeed.
We need to go to lunch, and I'm going to make this a very brief statement, because I would probably characterize it by what we just heard is really the characterization of Betty Hewlett.
Yeah.
It truly is, in that she has had, I know, a difficulty in making this transition, but I have appreciated that she comes prepared no matter what her challenges are and works so well, and her sit and listen to you, recognize and be so explicit, is really an example of exactly how you've worked. So I wish you well, and I will keep in contact with you. Thank you so much for all your service.
And Betty, I did want to say that it's been an incredible pleasure working with you. I mean, I don't know many people that I've ever worked with who were as reliable and somebody that I could always count on, who gave good advice, were always there. You know, it's been great making a team, the two of us, for the last 4 years. I've really enjoyed it, and I really appreciate it.
May I say something on behalf of staff? And I'll be very short. I want to thank you for your wise counsel and your guidance, but most of all, for your caring. You really cared about the customers. You really cared about the employees, staff, and you cared about WMATA, and that came through in everything you did, and I just really applaud you for that. Thank you so much.
And the meeting is formally adjourned.